This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. We're actually off this week, so we offer you a delicious replay of our special hour about ethanol. As in spirits, sauce, swill, grog, vino, plonk, suds, bubbles, booze. A wee dram, the devil's brew. We condemn it.
They want your sweet, innocent girls to take the booze so they can be enticed into honky-tonks by slick-haired vultures who prey on the flower of American womanhood. Alcohol must go!
Revel in it.
Throughout the Middle Ages, drunkenness was so common, it was unnoticed. They called it the Middle Ages because no one was able to walk home. Unless they were between two other fellows. I was the middle guy.
We fear it.
It goes by the nicknames blackout in a can and liquid cocaine.
Is the equivalent of four beers, a Red Bull, and a shot of espresso. The caffeine masks the alcohol, creating what the FDA calls wide awake drunks.
You can get very drunk, very fast, very cheaply. Maggie?
Very scary.
We need it.
My fur coat, so low, Lord, ain't it cold? But I'm not gonna holler, cause I still got a dollar. And when I get low, oh, I get high. When I get low, oh, I get high.
Alcohol has been humanity's companion through good times and ill. Even before we were human, primates are attracted to ethanol. In fact, the drunken monkey hypothesis proposed by Dr. Robert Dudley at Berkeley suggests that the attraction may once have been an evolutionary advantage. Ethanol leads the nose to overripe fruit rich in calories, as is ethanol itself. So, in a short life of scarcity, it's actually nutritious. But in a long life of abundance, potentially ruinous. We still argue about it. Sometimes the same arguments the ancients, maybe even the monkeys, had. It's that duality that attracted Ian Gately, the author of Drink, A Cultural History of Alcohol.
When I looked at the subject, what struck me most was this sort of Jekyll and Hyde aspects of alcohol. And in fact, the Greek god of wine, Dionysus, had exactly those two aspects to his character. He could be loving, and he was the patron of the theatre and of many of the arts, yet at the same time, he could be quite unpredictable too in his rage and violence.
The reference to alcohol in Gilgamesh, possibly the oldest literary work in existence, is when Gilgamesh, the king of a Mesopotamian city, wanted to team up with a wild man named Enkidu. They civilized Enkidu by giving him beer.
His heart grew light, his face glowed, and he sang out with joy. He washed, he rubbed sweet oil into his skin, and became fully human.
I notice through your book that beer is the working man's drink, and wine that of the elite or the effete. And this goes back to the ancient Egyptians, where probably the pyramids were built by seriously drunk people.
Yes, they had a ration of 1 1/3 gallons of beer per day. And this might have been as strong as 5%. Now, you know, if I was to drink that much beer in the hot sun whilst doing hard labor, I can't see how it wouldn't get me drunk. And beer, yes, is usually the working man or woman's drink. And wine, I mean, in the case of the Egyptians, they didn't really grow their own, so it was an imported luxury. And it was a tool for discrimination as much as anything else. You know, if you were the pharaoh, then you would have the best wine.
Some things never change. I bet the wine experts of the day couldn't tell the expensive wine from the cheap wine in a blind test, but never mind that.
Well, one wonders, yes.
The Greeks also favored wine. Poets and playwrights, politicians. You quote the epic poet Panaeus, who wrote, "Wine is like fire and aid and sweet relief, wards off all ills and comforts every grief. Wine can of every feast the joys enhance. It kindles soft desire, it leads the dance."
They really did see it as not simply a social lubricant, but also as inspiration. They believed that when people were engaging in oratory, that they really had to have a drink first, and that people who didn't drink were therefore suspect because they weren't revealing their true feelings. I mean, Demosthenes was one of the most famous orators of ancient Athens, and yet because he was a water drinker, people always rather doubted him.
Christians actually started with a fairly liberal attitude towards alcohol, at least in the earliest holy books.
And it's interesting, I think, that in both the Old and New Testament, there's very little in the way of a sort of concrete description of what heaven will be like. But in both, there will be wine there. Wine and alcohol was omnipresent, both in Judaism and Christianity. Jesus, obviously, one of his first miracles is to convert water into wine. And having declared at the Last Supper that this is my body, this is my blood, the act of transubstantiation being an important part of Christian worship thereafter.
So Aristotle had tried to distill wine into a pure spirit way back in the 4th century BC, but he couldn't figure out how.
It's a more delicate art than I think is commonly realized.
And ultimately perfected in a part of the world we've associated with being dogmatically opposed to alcohol, the Muslim world.
That's absolutely right. I mean, there's a reasonably explicit ban in the Quran against strong drink. And yet they were also masters of science for the time. I mean, so there's Geber in the 8th century, who's really the father of chemistry. You know, he sat down to classify substances and work out a little more about the nature of things. Al-Razi, a century later, found a substance which he called alcohol, which is obviously the root of our word alcohol.
Next to the Muslims, probably the strictest drinking culture that you described was that of the Aztecs. This seems to be the first civilization to impose a drinking age.
That's right. As far as we can judge from the accounts of the conquistadores, they had a minimum drinking age of 50 for both men and women.
And if you violated the drinking laws,
you could be stoned to death. There were, as ever, exceptions. So once again, it seems that the elite had rather freer access to alcohol. And warriors, too, were allowed to drink, and they seemed to have troughs of pulque outside some of the temples.
Pulque being the fermented sap of the agave plant.
That's correct. And the preparation of which was highly ceremonial. Like, the people responsible for preparing it had to forswear sex for a few days and isolate themselves from other people. And once it was ready, it had to be drunk very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
One of the conquistadores was recorded as saying, you know, there's no smell. Even a dead dog or a bomb going off won't clear a street quite as quickly as off pulque.
Now, one thing that was fascinating to me and related to the ceremony is among the exceptions, you talk about the warriors and some of the elites, but also it seems as if your astrological chart marked you as a rabbit. You had to drink.
Yes, it does appear that some people were literally cursed by the zodiac. Pulque was protected by the 400 moon rabbit gods of Pulque. And one sign of the Aztec zodiac, known as two rabbits, so if you were born under that, you were expected to be, if not prone, then actually just cursed to be a drunk. And people born under that sign were obviously allowed to drink, but they were vilified and they were expected to look, you know, like sort of sad and angry drunks, sort of staggering around badly dressed and, you know, cursed by everyone.
And you observed that every time spirits were introduced into a society for the first time, it caused destruction until people figured out how to control it.
That's right. It instantly had a very adverse effect on the populations. And we see this time and time again. We see it in Germany, where they're doing brandy burnt wine. And, you know, at first they're saying, oh, this is a marvelous elixir. It cures everything. You know, gonorrhea, syphilis, constipation, you know, and madness, madness in dogs, barrenness in women. I mean, some of the lists are simply ridiculous. But you also begin to see, you know, people suddenly dying from drink, which people weren't used to. The idea that someone could just simply drink a pint and then drop dead was pretty unusual to them.
As in the 1700s, the London gin craze. You wrote that in 1723, statistics suggested that every man, woman, and child in London knocked back more than a pint of gin per week. The impact was obviously shocking levels of public drunkenness in the capital.
That's right. Even cultures which had really a very long history of drinking, their culture didn't protect them against something which was so much stronger than what they were used to.
So let's shift to the New World. You note that the Indian name from which we derive the name Manhattan comes from a bibulous encounter with Henry Hudson back in 1609.
That's right. I mean, one of the recordings of it was the place where we got drunk together.
Reading your book, you get the sense that there are two arguments that have been made century after century against or for drinking alcohol. One centers on the health benefits, or lack thereof, and the other centers on the morality of it, or lack thereof. As you wrote, the prohibitionists in the U.S., the early ones, likened drinking to a moral failing, like slavery.
Those are the two threads. It's the Jekyll and Hyde. And today, a lot of surveys come out showing that moderate drinking of alcohol is good for you. And yet, on the other side of the coin, you've got excessive drinking is without doubt very bad for you. And not just for you, but the people who surround you. Should we not always have a clarity of mind which is unfuddled by the influence of alcohol? But then you could balance that with a resounding yes, that it's actually part of our nature, like eating meat. We are human because we drink alcohol.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much.
Ian Gately is the author of Drink, A Cultural History of Alcohol. This is On the Media.